Chapter 5. We went today to the big American ambulance hospital at Neuilly, and it was the most wonderful and awful place I have ever seen. They are doing miraculous work restoring faces that have been partly blown away. We saw plaster casts of faces before and after, and Margaret Cooper, remember, the one who knows Gilbert's cousin, proceeded to faint on the spot. Miss Alice Patton, class of 1910, to her sister, Mrs. Gilbert Thomas, who did not attend Smith, or even one of those other institutions that are not Smith. August 1917, Paris, France. They caught Miss Cooper just before she went over. It was amazing just how heavy one slender woman could be in a dead faint. It didn't help that she was tall, thought Kate, who wasn't. She could only be grateful that Dr. Blake's back was to them as he attempted to explain something to do with bone grafts to Maud, who, for all her other sins, wasn't the least bit squeamish. Julia looked back over her shoulder, frowning, and for once, Kate couldn't blame her. She didn't want Dr. Blake to see one of their number fainting either. Lady doctors, indeed. "We've got to get her out of here," she hissed to Emmy, who nodded faintly, her hair already coming out of its pins. "You moved his leg to his face?" Maud's strident tones covered the sound of Miss Cooper's heels dragging across the floor. Kate could have kissed her. "My dear girl, it doesn't work quite like that," said the doctor indulgently. "Now, if you'll see, a bit of bone from the shin, grafted to the chin."
"I feel like Dr. Frankenstein, stealing bodies," muttered Kate as they maneuvered through the door. She could feel the sweat gathering under her arms and along the small of her back. "I'm not sure they don't do that here," panted Emmy.
Sometimes Kate forgot the difference in their heights. Emmy tended to fold over onto herself, making herself smaller. But when it came to dragging a body between them, those 8 inches mattered. Emmy was bent double, trying to stay level with Kate, tripping over her own feet.
"Do you think we can set her down here?"
Here was an abandoned office, a cubbyhole of an office, crammed with papers, maps, and notices tacked to the walls. Kate was fairly sure it was a dreadful place to put a body. She was equally sure that if she tried to move Miss Cooper any farther, Miss Cooper wasn't going to be the only one in the infirmary.
"Yes," she said, resisting the urge to drop her side of the burden. "Together now."
Together, they lowered Miss Cooper to the ground, her head and shoulders propped on Emmy's lap. She was breathing shallowly, her skin clammy with sweat. Emmy removed Miss Cooper's hatpin and smoothed the hair back from her brow. Kate felt her wrist.
"She has a pulse, at least."
What that pulse was, or what it was supposed to be, Kate had no idea. Emmy looked up at Kate, her face distressed.
"I knew I ought to have taken a nursing course.
This place is teeming with nurses," said Kate roughly,
because she felt just as useless. This did not bode well for their utility out in the ravaged French countryside.
"She doesn't need a nurse, just a vial of smelling salts or a splash of cold water. Kate, it was awful, admit it. That last cast?"
Awful, yes, but also incredible that the doctors could play with flesh like clay, could mold it back into shape, or almost back into shape. Kate thought of her father, dead from a blow to the head from a horse's hoof. He hadn't died immediately. What might these doctors have done? Would they have reached into his very brain and brought him back?
"It's incredible what they do. Awe-inspiring, even."
Standing, Kate brushed her hands on her skirt. They were in a hospital, for goodness sake.
"Someone here must have smelling salts."
Emmy was squinting worriedly at Miss Cooper.
"Do you think this is why Mrs. Rutherford wanted us here? To test us?"
"I don't know. Maybe."
It was impossible to tell with Mrs. Rutherford how much was method and how much madness. If it was a test, Kate didn't like to think what it signified that they were already one down.
"But we're not going to work with wounded,"
Not these sort of wounded.
Kate wished Emmy wouldn't look at her like that, as though she had the answers. None of them had any idea what the Germans had done to the villagers whose homes they had occupied.
It's meant to be social work, visiting children and bringing them milk.
Don't forget the chickens, said Kate.
Emmy smiled despite herself.
I've been doing my best to forget the chickens. I only volunteered to keep the peace. Although I imagine chickens could be rather sweet.
Or rather smelly.
Ouch!
Kate pulled back, rubbing her shoulder as a door banged open into her back.
Dr. Blake, I need...
said a very clipped, very British voice. The man who went along with the voice stopped himself just short of tripping over Margaret's feet, which, admittedly, were stretched across most of the available floor space.
You're not Dr. Blake.
Dr. Blake is busy, said Kate, her arms smarting. Come back later.
You don't work here, said the man.
He was tall and thin, with dark hair clipped close to his head and a narrow mustache above his lips. He looked down his nose at them in a way that made Kate feel even shorter than her 5'1".
Do you?
We were touring the hospital and one of our friends was taken ill, said Emmy,
automatically apologizing, as Emmy always did.
We know we probably shouldn't be in here, but we thought we ought to be out of the way.
She saw the wounded and keeled over, did she?
Said the man, who had, thought Kate, no business at all being so disagreeable. She was about to tell him so when Emmy lifted her chin and said with great dignity,
Her breakfast disagreed with her. It's the sort of thing that could happen to anyone, really. It's the war bread, you see.
You haven't any smelling salts, have you?
Kate asked before they could digress into the culinary. The Englishman pulled on his gloves with sharp, jerky movements.
I didn't come equipped for swooning maidens. Now, if you'll excuse me.
Swooning maidens?
Emmy gave a gurgle of a laugh.
You make us sound like something out of a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. You know, the bit where the Pirate King starts shouting about maidens and they all run about. Well, anyway. But we're not like that. We're les collégiennes américaines.
The Englishman stared at Emmy and then said,
Three little maids from school, then.
17, actually, said Emmy. We'll be 18 when our agriculturalist arrives. We're a relief unit sent by Smith College.
Genius tutelary indeed. What are you meant to be relieving?
11 distressed villages in the area of Grécourt, said Kate sharply. Look, are you going to help or not?
Grécourt?
Yes, you can find it on that map over there. Are those our lines?
Emmy added, her attention caught by the American flag stuck to the map on the wall.
You aren't supposed to see that.
The British officer stepped between her and the map, nearly trampling on Miss Cooper in the process.
You aren't supposed to be here.
If we're that much in the way, we'll move, said Kate.
She bent down next to Miss Cooper, prepared to lift her.
You needn't concern yourself.
That's not what I meant.
The British officer drew in a deep breath through his nose. There was rage in that voice, spilling out through the cultured vowels, the carefully controlled words.
This is no place for untrained amateurs. Not in this office, not in this hospital, and certainly not at Grécourt. Go see the Louvre, walk along the Seine, but don't get in the way of the real business of the war. You've no idea what you're playing at.
Emmy peered up at the angry officer. Her eyes were a very light blue, as faded as her pale lashes. They always made her look nearsighted, even though she wasn't.
Were you a professional soldier before the war?
The Brit checked, choking on his words.
Well, no, but that's different. It's not as though I had any choice in the matter.
Emmy sat back on her heels, politely curious.
Were you constrained to enlist?
Was I? No.
He looked like he'd been slapped. Then the mustache quirked.
I'd hardly admit it if I were. But no, I volunteered. More fool I.
And so did we, said Emmy quietly.
Her hands moved gently against Miss Cooper's hair.
We all do what we can. We know we haven't much experience, but we mean to learn.
He stared at her, wordlessly. Some of the tension seemed to drain away from his shoulders, leaving him looking gray and impossibly weary. When he spoke, his voice was completely without inflection.
"France is a dangerous schoolroom. If you take my advice, go home. Go home now. And forget you ever saw any of this."
Emmy cocked her head at him.
"It's not the sort of thing one can just forget, is it? And having seen it, how can one go home and do nothing?"
He gave a sharp laugh.
"Quite easily. You'd be surprised how little one can do when one sets one's mind to it."
On the floor, Miss Cooper stirred, making a faint noise. The British officer nodded at her.
"I'll send a nurse to you, for your fallen comrade."
And he was gone, his footsteps echoing along the hall. Miss Cooper moaned. Emmy bent over her.
"Miss Cooper? Margaret?"
To Kate, she said,
"I think we tell the others that we needed to answer a call of nature."
"Your friend is sending a nurse to us," Kate pointed out. To her surprise, Emmy's cheeks turned a faint pink.
"He's not my friend, just a helpful stranger."
"Helpful?" Kate had found him rude beyond bearing. "Or do all British men act like they own the earth?"
"Well, they do, don't they? Own it, I mean," said Emmy.
Kate had forgotten Emmy's inability to recognize a rhetorical question. She always considered them solemnly, as though they were the prompt for writing a theme.
"The pink bits of it, at least. Now, Margaret, don't fret. We'll just get you a bit of water and you'll feel right as rain in a minute."
Miss Cooper was still a bit gray about the gills when they made it back to the hotel on the Quai Voltaire. "You shouldn't feel bad, you know," said Miss England quietly to Miss Cooper as they walked from the tram to the hotel. "About today, every time I looked at those pictures, I saw my brother's face."
"Is he here?"
asked Emmy, trotting alongside with one arm protectively through Miss Cooper's, mothering with all her might.
"With the 11th Engineers."
Miss England paused to let Maud and Liza brush past her.
"Maybe we'll get lucky. Maybe it will be all over by the time our boys are moved to the front."
"Maybe," echoed Kate, glad she was behind them, glad Miss England couldn't see her face. That map they'd seen, the map they weren't supposed to see. The American flags had been planted right behind the front lines. She was shamefully grateful that her own brothers were still too young to join up. Her mother's real family.
"I, for one," said Maud loudly, turning back as she pushed open the door of the hotel, "think we ought to be doing something for our soldiers, not going off to milk cows for French peasants, don't you? And I mean to tell Mrs. Rutherford that. Oh, Mrs. Rutherford, I didn't see you there."
If Mrs. Rutherford heard what Maud said, she didn't let on. She did, however, sit them down and proceed to issue a series of rapid instructions. Their trucks would, at best, take another 2 weeks. In the meantime, there was work to be done and purchases to be made. Emmy was put in charge of acquiring 6 cows, a bull, 3 pigs, 100 chickens, 18 pairs of rabbits, and, if time and budget permitted, possibly some goats.
"Barnum and Bailey travels with less," exclaimed Maud, horrified. "People will think the circus has come to town." "Ah, Miss Randolph, you can be in charge of buying yarns, cloth, and woolens. I would advise starting at La Samaritaine. You'll find it's rather like Gimbel's."
"I don't shop at Gimbel's," said Maud blankly.
"La Samaritaine," said Mrs. Rutherford, "is giving us a 5% discount."
And that was that. Kate was rather less amused by Maud's discomfort when she herself was tasked with buying $200 worth of agricultural tools. She refrained from pointing out that she wouldn't know a garden implement if it bit her. She suspected that Mrs. Rutherford would only inform her that there was no time like the present to learn. At least it wasn't chickens. While they were all in the midst of their orgy of shopping, Mrs. Rutherford was to tour the devastated areas. The doctors would visit hospitals.
The rest of them, once they acquired their permits, would be loaned out to various organizations for the duration of their time in Paris, offered a choice of packing and unpacking supplies for the American Fund for French Wounded, rolling bandages for the Surgical Dressings Committee of the Red Cross, or manufacturing special splints for the wounded at the Société pour les Blessés in the Bois de Boulogne. Kate had chosen the latter. She tried not to think what her mother would say about going all the way to Paris to engage in factory work, unpaid. For that, she might have stayed in Brooklyn, and been paid for it. The only saving grace was that their cots had arrived and were lined up in two rows in the attic, like the beds for the seven little men in Snow White. Kate crawled wearily into her cot, ridiculously grateful for something approximating a bed. It had been a long time since she had done anything more strenuous than write on a chalkboard. After carrying Margaret, her body felt as though someone had been at it with a hammer. And it was delicious to be on a mattress again, even only a sort of mattress, and not on a floor or deck. Kate? She heard the cot next to her creak as Emmy rolled in her direction. Kate, are you awake? She considered pretending to be asleep, but couldn't quite make herself do it. Yes?
I can't stop thinking about Nurse Fellows.
That morning felt like years ago already. It seemed absurd they'd only been in Paris for a day. It felt more like weeks. The Canadian nurse with the red hair.
I know. It's foolish of me.
Kate could hear Emmy thrashing about in the bedclothes.
We didn't even see her foot. It wasn't like those pictures we saw of the men without noses or, oh, you know. And her face, I suppose it's the sort of thing that might happen if your hair caught fire on a candle, or you accidentally leaned too close to a fire, or goodness only knows what. Not necessarily a war injury. These sorts of things do happen. I met a woman at the settlement house who had lost both her eyebrows to a mistake with a gas jet.
Kate groaned and buried her face in her pillow.
Emmy, what are you talking about?
Nurse Fellows. Every time I close my eyes, I keep seeing her face with all those scars.
Emmy sat up, swinging her legs over the side of the cot. Kate could see her in the darkness as a vague outline, long braid down over one shoulder.
It's just that one doesn't expect nurses to be hurt. Soldiers, they know they're going to be shot at, but nurses?
Reluctantly, Kate propped herself up on one arm. I don't imagine shells discriminate based on profession.
It seems wrong somehow to hurt someone who's trying to heal. War is war, I understand that, but when someone is trying to do good, I don't imagine they do it on purpose.
It felt like being back at Smith again, whispering back and forth in the middle of the night, although, admittedly, the subject matter had changed somewhat. Kate had forgotten what it was to have a confidant, someone to talk to in the middle of the night. The last 6 years had been solitary ones. She had gone skating a time or two with her fellow teachers, and to the cinema as opportunity offered, but the acquaintance had never turned into friendship. The fault was hers, she knew. She felt as though she were a fraud, that if anyone got too close, they would know her for what she was. Not Kate Moran, Smith graduate, but Katie Moranchik, whose mother scrubbed floors to keep a roof over their heads. It was only Emmy who had seemed not to care about that, not to see her as less, until Julia had spoiled it all. Emmy shivered and drew the blanket up around her shoulders.
Someone told me the Germans deliberately fire at the ambulances. I know I'm not much to look at, but it's one thing to be plain with the face one is born with, and quite another thing to be disfigured. Does that make me a coward?
Emmy. Kate struggled to a sitting position, peering at her friend's face in the darkness. Is this because of that horrible British officer?
He wasn't horrible. I don't think he was unkind so much as sad. When you think about what he must have seen, he looks as though he hasn't slept in a month.
Kate muffled a yawn. You aren't going to offer to go plump his pillows, are you? That would be taking the Angel of Mercy act too far.
I'm not trying to put on an act.
The hurt in Emmy's voice was enough to kill any thought of falling asleep.
I didn't mean that. I mean, I didn't mean it like that.
Kate squeezed her eyes shut. They'd lost the habit of speaking to one another. It was like speaking a language at which she'd once been fluent and finding she was using all the wrong verbs.
It's been a long day. I hardly know what I'm saying. I guess I'm rattled too.
I'm sorry, said Emmy, immediately all concern.
I should have thought. Never mind, said Kate quickly.
The last thing she needed was Emmy worrying over her. That would make her feel truly worm-like.
We won't be that near the front, you know. I doubt they'll think us worth shelling.
And even if they did, it would be worth it, wouldn't it? Emmy's voice was very small in the large room. Kate could hear Miss Patton snoring on the far side of the room.
For the children, I should be thinking of them, not us.
Said Kate.
It will all be better once we get there. It's the waiting that's so hard, said Emmy.
And Kate didn't point out that she had said the same thing on the boat, that it would all be better once they got to Paris. Well, here they were in Paris. And they did have cots, so she supposed that was better, by a certain value of better.
Of course it will, said Kate,
and hoped the woman who had once been her best friend wouldn't realize she was lying. Chapter 6. Liza and I had a letter today from the YMCA director inviting us to help them in their canteen. We wish we could. It's for our troops, but we know Mrs. R will never let us off. We are expected to love the cows and chickens. I personally consider her quite barmy. Something will have to be done. I expect I'll have to do it, since no one else will bother. Miss Maud Randolph, class of 1909, to her fiancé, Mr. Henry Craig. August 1917. Paris, France. There is a tavern way down in Brittany, where weary soldiers take their liberty. The keeper's daughter, whose name is Madelon, pours out the wine while they laugh and carry on. The troops crowded into the basement hall of the Gare du Nord, banged on the tables, raising their glasses to the singer who was belting out a popular ballad in both French and English. This was their last hurrah, one last bit of Paris to take away with them as they waited for the trains that would carry them back to the front. Emmy hovered behind the soldiers, a tray of cigarettes in her hands, trying to figure out what she was meant to do. Oh, Madelon, you are the only one. Oh, Madelon, for you will carry on. There had been a comedian on earlier. Emmy hadn't heard all the jokes. She'd been at the wrong end of the room for that. But from the way the men laughed, she'd suspected they might have been bawdy. Or maybe the men would have guffawed at anything just then. But now the night had moved on. The wine had been poured and poured again, and the men were singing along, raggedly, singing to keep from crying. But Madelon, she takes it all in fun. She laughs and says, "You see, it can't be done." There was something so terribly lonesome in that song. The room was crowded with men, hot with perspiration. Emmy wondered if each of them felt as alone as she did right now. "You'll come with us to help out the Red Cross at the Gare du Nord, won't you?" Maud had asked, taking Emmy's agreement for granted, and Emmy had agreed, not so much because she wanted to, but because it was driving her half mad, drifting along, waiting for their real work to begin. It wasn't that she was idle. 7 hours a day, every day, Emmy sat in a temporary barrack in the Bois de Boulogne, making casts out of plaster of Paris, ward boots, chin supports, splints. Maud and Liza had volunteered with the Red Cross. One of the other women, Miss Mills, had chosen to nurse at the Villiers Fund Hospital with another Smith classmate, not a member of the unit. The doctors were away, touring hospitals in the war zone, but the rest of the Smith College relief unit went every day from the hotel on the Quai Voltaire to the workroom Pour les Blessés on the Bois de Boulogne. The women chatted as they worked, sharing bits of themselves in the way one did when one's hands were occupied, speaking of their families, their lives, their work. Emmy learned about Miss England's brother in the 11th Engineers and her invalid mother, who was always having spasms. They heard a great deal about Miss Patton's younger sister and her new husband, who had been Miss Patton's beau first, or at least had seemed to be. Not that she said it in so many words, but it was clear all the same, at least to Emmy, who was used to receiving confidences and reading between the lines. Except with Kate. The only one Emmy couldn't read these days was Kate. No one could say Kate shirked, because she didn't. She turned out more splints than the rest of them put together. No one could call her unfriendly. She listened and commented and even joked, but she never, not once, shared anything about herself. Not even late at night in the quiet of the attic room. Not even to Emmy. Emmy tried to make things better. She redoubled her attempts, falling over backward to try to show Kate how much she was still her friend, that it was all just the same as it had always been. But the more she tried to jolly her, the more Kate had withdrawn behind her eyes, faultlessly polite, the reserve that had always been part of her hardening into a wall, and Emmy hadn't the slightest idea how to make her come out of it again. So when Maud asked Emmy to volunteer to help with the show the Red Cross put on at the Gare du Nord for departing soldiers, Emmy said yes, just to have something to do, some place to go. And maybe, just a bit, so it wouldn't look like she was quite so starved for companionship. She didn't particularly like Maud or Liza, but they were there. Except they weren't. They moved easily through the crowd, laughing and joking with the men, while Emmy stood in the back, feeling awkward and not quite sure what to do with herself. She had never been good at mixed social occasions, always too aware of her height, her protruding teeth, her fadeaway lashes, all those things that made her, in a word, plain. She didn't have that facility for flirting that seemed to come naturally to Maud. With boys she'd known forever, she could be comfortable, but it was different with strangers. Aunt May had always been quite clear. There was only one reason any man would approach Emmy, not her face, but her fortune. Emmy was just considering, not very enthusiastically, the prospect of circulating around the room with her tray of cigarettes when a soldier detached himself from a group and came up to her.
"Cigarette?"
Emmy said brightly, as a tall, thin man in a well-worn uniform approached.
"Do you think I deserve one?"
asked a clipped, patrician voice. Emmy's head snapped up. She was staring at a lean, tanned face, less haggard now than the last time she had seen it, but unmistakably the same.
"You're the man from the hospital."
"I would understand if you would rather disavow the acquaintance."
With an effort, he added,
"I saw you here and saw my chance to make good on my bad behavior of the other day. To put it bluntly, I owe you an apology."
He'd had a bath since she'd last seen him. Emmy could smell sandalwood soap, which made a rather nice contrast to some of the other smells in the room. He'd also shaved, but the mustache was still there, a thin dark line over his upper lip. She probably shouldn't be staring at his lips, Emmy realized, and hastily began rearranging her tray of cigarettes.
"There's no need for that. It wasn't your fault we were blocking Dr. Blake's office. I imagine it must be pretty maddening to be looking for someone and find three prone women instead. Are you sure I can't interest you in a cigarette?"
"Only one of you was prone, and it was my fault that I took out my ill temper on you and your friend."
There was something about his voice that demanded her attention. She could see the muscles in his throat work as he searched for the right words.
"I was visiting a friend in the hospital. A man who ought to be at Oxford now, staring at bugs through a microscope and marveling at the miracle of wings,
not blind in both eyes, staggering about on one leg.
She knew men like that. The U.S. hadn't entered the war until the spring, but there had been Yale men who had felt strongly about protecting France any way they could, who had volunteered at the first word of war back in 1914, some in the air, some in the volunteer ambulance service, some in the French Foreign Legion. She could think of at least one cousin who ought to have been in New Haven right now, writing about the foreign policy of some long-ago King Louis, not buried in a graveyard somewhere in France. But she couldn't explain all that, so she said only, "It's a horrible waste, isn't it?" The Englishman looked down at her, and she knew he wasn't really seeing her at all.
"We thought we'd blaze over here in a moment of glory, see off the Hun and go home. We thought it was something like a holiday. And then to see you, more of you, going off as we did."
"Not in a blaze of glory, though," said Emmy. At the farewell luncheon, a poem had been read to them, comparing them to the heroes of the old sagas now reborn in female form. It had been lovely and terribly inspiring, but even at the time, Emmy had rather doubted its applicability.
"We're not looking for glory, just to do something decent and worthwhile."
"Does that still exist in the world?"
"I should hope so. I think so. I don't know that we'll accomplish anything particularly heroic, but if we get milk to even a handful of children, that's something, isn't it? At least, it is to those children."
His dark eyes were fixed on her face, almost alarming in their intensity. At last, he said,
"Yes, it is."
It would have been nice to think he meant it. Emmy set her tray down on a table.
"You think we're very naive, don't you?"
He reached into his jacket pocket for a cigarette case, his eyes never leaving hers. He drew it out, a silver one with a monogram on it.
"Would you rather I called it idealistic?"
"I'd rather honesty than flattery."
It was, she supposed, one of the benefits of being plain. One learned early on to discern flummery. She laughed at herself, her eyes crinkling.
"You needn't sugarcoat it. Sugar's been rationed and we've had our quota already."
She surprised him into a laugh. It was raw and hoarse, but quite definitely a laugh all the same.
"So it has. All right, yes, I do think it naive. You haven't been to the front. You haven't seen
what the Germans can do."
Here, Emmy felt on firmer footing.
"I'm not a hothouse flower, you know. I've spent the last 5 years doing settlement house work. I've seen more than you think."
"Like the men at the American Ambulance Hospital?"
"No, nothing quite like that. At least, not on that sort of scale."
How could she explain to him? She'd seen women with hands mangled from being drawn into machinery. She'd seen a pregnant woman so badly beaten by her husband that she'd lost the child, and yet still gone home to him after. She'd seen a child whose arm was a mass of scar tissue from having fallen, or been pushed, into a coal fire. She'd seen cruelty, but this was different somehow. It was the impersonal nature of it that made it so horrifying.
"That wasn't even the half of it. What you're letting yourself in for."
Unthinkingly, Emmy put her hand on his arm, trying to reassure him.
"It's kind of you to be concerned. We won't be working with the ambulances at the front. We'll be in a village, well behind the lines. The conditions may be different from a city slum, but the needs are the same. Shelter, clothing, food, affection. Those children need to know someone cares for them. The worse it is, the more that matters."
"And you have affection to spare?"
Her hand was still on his arm. Emmy snatched it away.
"The last I looked, kindness wasn't rationed."
"Are you quite sure?"
The officer inclined his head, saying formally,
"I wish you well, Miss
Van Alden."
She had been rather enjoying the anonymity. People tended to react to the name Van Alden because they were in awe of her lineage, offended by her mother, or sometimes both. The British officer merely bowed over her hand.
"Miss Van Alden."
He didn't seem to know who she was at all, and Emmy found that strangely wonderful.
Do you realize I don't even know your name?
Perhaps I prefer to dwell in mystery, like the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Emmy couldn't quite hide her delight. She adored that book, had read it at least a dozen times, possibly more, no matter how many times Kate had protested, it was all entirely improbable, and anyone would have known who he was inside 5 minutes.
Do I find myself addressing Sir Percy Blakeney, Baronet?
He smiled down at her, a little creakily.
You've discovered me, I see.
Do those Frenchies seek you everywhere?
He grimaced.
It's not much of a guess whether this is heaven or hell.
The mind is its own place, quoted Emmy, feeling a bit giddy. And in itself can make a heaven of hell, a hell of heaven.
When Milton wrote that, said the British officer wryly, he'd clearly never been to the Sum. Besides, it's not fair switching authors. Next, I'll trot out John Donne, and then we'll be wallowing in Shakespeare before you know it.
Would that be so terrible?
Asked Emmy, enjoying herself tremendously and feeling vaguely guilty about it.
It depends on whether you mean to quote Much Ado or Titus Andronicus.
Possibly Troilus and Cressida, said Emmy determinedly, but never Titus.
What plagues and what portents, he recited softly. What mutiny, frights, changes, horrors, enterprise is sick. There's your Troilus and Cressida for you, and all too apt. Didn't I tell you we were in danger of Shakespeare once we started?
We could try Keats instead, suggested Emmy, wanting to shake that frozen look from his face.
Beauty is truth. Maybe this means then that all this ugliness is nothing but a lie, an illusion, but it's a very solid one.
He took her hand, his skin surprisingly warm through his gloves.
I would far rather stay and debate poets, but I have a rendezvous with a train.
It hit Emmy like a vat of cold water.
Wait, are you going back to...
To the front, yes.
Of course he was. That was why he was here. That was why they were all here. In the delight of finding someone who spoke her language, even a slightly foreign dialect of it, she had allowed herself to forget, and the full horror of it rushed back upon her, choking her.
I wish you well.
What else did one say to a man heading to horrors unspeakable?
Good luck.
And to you,
he said solemnly. He raised his hat to her.
To decency and those who persist in practicing it.
With that, he was gone, walking away, straight-backed. He hadn't, Emmy realized, ever told her his name.
Who was that? Demanded Maud, arriving pink-cheeked with an empty basket.
Emmy looked after him, joining a group of men similarly garbed.
Sir Percy Blakeney, Baronet.
Oh, is he a friend of your family? Maud didn't wait for her to answer, setting down her empty basket on the table and adjusting her hat to a more becoming angle.
It's amazing the people one knows who one meets here. Liza and I just bumped right into the cousin of a friend of one of my parents' neighbors from Montclair.
Emmy didn't even try to untangle the relationship. She let Maud ramble on while she looked again for the British officer, but there were too many khaki uniforms to find one specific one. It seemed unlikely she would ever see him again. Their discussion felt already vaguely unreal. But she was glad, glad to have met him even for that moment. It had made her feel like herself again for the first time in a very long time.
Which is why what I wanted to talk to you about is so important.
What you wanted? Emmy blinked, trying to remember what Maud had been saying. Maud sighed with exaggerated patience.
Yes, about our boys. I really think it's absurd that we're bothering with livestock and all that when we could be here doing something for our boys.
Emmy looked out at the rows and rows of troops, French and English and American. One could tell the Americans because they looked much better fed than their continental counterparts, their uniforms fresher and cleaner.
But we are here, doing something for our boys. Yes, now. But what about when Mrs. Rutherford gets back? If she has her way, she'll drag us out to some godforsaken place to do goodness only knows what.
But we do know what, said Emmy, feeling vaguely bewildered. We're to offer aid to those in the devastated zone.
You mean practically in the trenches, said Maud. That might have made sense 4 months ago, but you must agree, now that the new offensive is on, it's perfectly insane to be even thinking of going anywhere near the front.
There's a new offensive on?
That was one of the strangest things about being in Paris. They heard so much less about the war than they had in New York. The censors did their work well. But Maud appeared to have her ways, which, as far as Emmy could tell, consisted of dining out with a great many friends of friends and shamelessly interrogating all of them. Didn't you hear? They're clearing out all the Paris hospitals to make room for more wounded.
No, I hadn't heard, admitted Emmy.
She spared a thought for Julia and Dr. Stringfellow, touring hospitals, Mrs. Rutherford at Graycourt.
But surely the passes wouldn't have been issued if it were unsafe.
It's a war, said Maud, as though Emmy were particularly slow. Everything is unsafe. But really, it's quite mad to make oneself even less safe, and to do it to play milkmaid for a bunch of French peasants.
But you knew what it was when you joined, said Emmy carefully. It was always clear we were meant to be offering civilian relief. Mrs. Rutherford was quite specific about that.
She could still remember the way the room had stilled as Mrs. Rutherford spoke, back at the Smith College Club in Boston in April, telling of the evils she had seen in France, the good they could do. They, American college women, with their will and wit and resourcefulness to comfort the forgotten and give shelter to the homeless. Mrs. Rutherford, retorted Maud, is a ridiculous old pacifist. I pointed out to her what we could be doing for our troops, and do you know what she told me? She told me that men will always tear things up, and it's our job to put things back together. As if we were on a different side from our own boys. It's absurd. Not to mention her obsession with farm animals. I think she's quite mad, and I'm going to tell the committee so.
You're going to tell the committee?
That a group of us agree Mrs. Rutherford isn't fit to lead. We're just wasting their money on cows and plows and chickens. And all this with the trucks. I'm sure we'd have had them ages ago if she hadn't annoyed everyone.
I don't think that's really the problem, began Emmy, but Maud didn't seem to hear her.
It would mean so much if you would lend your name to our appeal, Maud said, and Emmy could feel herself freezing. Oblivious, Maud went on. Of course, we could very well do it on our own, and we will, but your name would add it extra weight. Not her, just her name. It was always what they really wanted. Not Emmy, who liked to read Tennyson and secretly enjoyed playing with children's cookery sets to make miniature pies, but Miss Van Alden of the Fifth Avenue Van Aldens, connected by blood or marriage to every Knickerbocker family of consequence, to all those Dutch and Huguenot and Mayflower descendants who had come to New York to trade in furs or silks and made themselves lords of the new land, in fact, if not in name. They looked at her and saw not a tall, awkward girl with buck teeth and a long chin and flyaway hair, but that long and silent procession of Van Aldens and Stuyvesants and Livingstons and Schuylers. It was one of the reasons she had taken to Kate so quickly all those years ago. Kate hadn't the first idea who any of those people were or why they mattered. Well, will you? Maud asked impatiently. We have it all written and ready to send off. Of course, it would also help if you would tell your mother. I'm sure people would listen to her, and then we could start doing the work that truly matters.
No.
The word was barely audible. Maud stared at her, and Emmy tried again.
Our plans are already so well forward, it would be a waste at this point.
Maud waved her hand dismissively. You mean because they put plumbing into a bunch of army barracks? I'm sure someone else can get some use out of it.
On the stage, the last song was drawing to a close. The men looked so sad, the last reprieve ending, the trains waiting. "To decency," the officer had said, "and those who persist in practicing it." She would persist. She would.
"It's not because of the plumbing," Emmy said earnestly, trying to make Maud understand, wanting Maud to understand. "It's because there are women and children there waiting for us. They've been told we'll come. They're relying on us. It's summer now still, but what happens when winter comes? Could you live with yourself if a child died of exposure while we fed soup to the troops?"
"Well, that's a bit melodramatic, isn't it?" protested Maud. "Like the little match girl. We don't know these children."
"We don't know these troops either."
Emmy hurried on before Maud could explain exactly how she knew them and just who knew whom from Montclair.
"If we hadn't committed to this, some other group might have come forward and done the work, but we did. Having done so, don't you think we owe it to them?"
"No," said Maud bluntly. "Now, about removing Mrs. Rutherford." So much for standing up for what she believed in.
"Will you excuse me?" asked Emmy. "I believe some of those men might want some cigarettes before they go."
And she fled. It was the next morning before Emmy had the opportunity to unburden herself to Kate. She'd wanted to tell Kate immediately, but Kate had been asleep already when she came back. And besides, Emmy wasn't entirely sure Maud hadn't already suborned Miss Patton, who seemed pleasant enough, but a bit nervous and changeable and not exactly steady of purpose. So she'd waited until after breakfast, when the others were getting ready to go, and made Kate stay with her downstairs in the breakfast room, pouring it all out in an anxious whisper with one eye on the door, just in case Maud or Liza might wander in search of another piece of war bread.
"Do you think we ought to tell her? Mrs. Rutherford, I mean," Emmy asked breathlessly. "That Maud and Liza are
planning a coup?" Kate provided for her.
"Well, yes."
It sounded rather melodramatic put that way, but that was what it was, wasn't it? A coup.
"I think we ought, don't you?"
Kate was quiet for a long moment. "Would it be such a bad thing to stay in Paris?" Emmy looked at her in dismay.
"But that's not what we're here to do."
She couldn't explain it even to herself, but it mattered that they were going to Grécourt. It felt silly and self-important to describe it as a call, like Joan of Arc and her voices, but that was what it was. When she closed her eyes, she could see the boys and girls of Grécourt calling to her, needing her.
"You don't think they have a point, do you?"
"I think," said Kate carefully, and that very care was somehow alarming, because it meant that Kate was watching her words, was watching them with her, Emmy, "that we're more than qualified for canteen work, or even to go on with what we're doing now. I'm not sure we have the skills to reconstruct a destroyed village, much less 11 destroyed villages. Liza can barely speak French, and to call me a chauffeur is nothing short of absurd."
"You passed your test."
Emmy felt a little clutch of panic in her chest.
"Only because the person just before me crashed into a camion, and goodness only knows how many crates of apples. The street was impassable for nearly an hour." "Aren't you underestimating yourself? And besides, you learned before. I remember you driving me down Thames Street in Newport without bashing into anything at all."
"Yes, but that was 6 years ago," said Kate. And there it was. Emmy could feel those 6 years sitting between them, weighing on them like lead. 6 years of distance against 4 years of friendship.
"Has that much changed?" she asked,
and she knew she wasn't just talking about driving.
"You're still the same person you were."
"Yes, but the car isn't," said Kate, and Emmy felt like she'd been very neatly put off. Again. Some of her distress must have shown, because Kate leaned across the table and gave her cold hand a quick squeeze.
"Emmy, don't worry. I'm not part of Maud's cabal. I don't think she'd even think to ask me. I just wonder, that's all."
"I don't," said Emmy in a small voice, but she didn't know if Kate heard her because a horn was honking outside, gears grinding, people shouting, doors flinging open, footsteps running down the stairs. What on earth? Kate ran to the window, Emmy bashing her shin against a chair as she followed, and there, in the middle of the street, was an army truck, cheerfully beeping its horn, and on top of it, in full unit uniform and an alarmingly large hat with a feather, sat Mrs. Rutherford.
"Well, that's an entrance for you," said Kate, looking at Emmy.
"Girls!" Mrs. Rutherford was calling as she waved farewell to her escort. "Girls!"
"We thought it was the Germans," said Maud crossly, coming downstairs with her hat in her hand.
"Not the Germans, the French. They were kind enough to give me a lift from the station," said Mrs. Rutherford, swinging her maltreated carpet bag to the ground. Her face looked thinner than it had 2 weeks ago, but it glowed with windburn and joy.
"All is arranged for us. I've left them at Greycourt waiting for our arrival. I can't tell you how much they need us."
Emmy felt the tight knot in her chest relax a bit.
"But our trucks," she said hesitantly.
"Ha," said Mrs. Rutherford. "The people of Greycourt need us, and they need us now. It's absurd to sit here waiting for our trucks any longer. If Mahomet won't come to the mountain..."
"Mahomet? Is he one of the Algerian soldiers?"
asked Liza. Mrs. Rutherford ignored her.
"Miss Cooper, Miss England, Miss Moran, Miss Patton, Miss Shaw, make your excuses to your places of employment and pack your bags. If the trucks won't come to us, we must go to Saint-Nazaire and get them. If we leave tonight, we can be in Saint-Nazaire by morning. I've booked places for us on the train."
Liza cast an anxious look at Maud.
"So fast?"
"It's actually a rather slow train," said Mrs. Rutherford, unpinning her hat and drawing off her gloves. "But it was the best one available, and I'm sure none of us minds a bit of discomfort in a good cause. We'll fetch our trucks and be off to Greycourt within the week."
"You see," murmured Kate as they went up the stairs to the attic. "You were worried for nothing."
"Yes," said Emmy.
It was a relief that Mrs. Rutherford was here and that they might, just might, actually get started. But she wasn't sure that Maud would give up so easily. And she couldn't quite forget that Kate hadn't wanted to go.